Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're always looking for those fascinating connections. And today, well, we've got a really interesting one.
We certainly do.
We're diving into high art and high finance. It sounds a bit strange, maybe.
A little, perhaps.
But we're talking about masterpieces, you know, the kind you see in museums, but also used as serious collateral for big loans.
Exactly. It's about how these incredible works of art become financial assets, powerful ones.
It really makes you look at art differently, doesn't it?
It does. And our mission today, really, is to explore what makes certain artists' work so valuable. Valuable enough for, say, a high-end pawnbroker to lend millions against it.
So you've got a list, right, from a luxury pawnbroker?
That's right, a curated list. We want to unpack the why behind it. Why these artists? What drives that value, that desirability, from a lender's point of view?
Okay, so thinking about things like market stability, verifiable history.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Liquidity, provenance, sustained demand, all those factors that make something a solid asset, not just, you know, beautiful to look at.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Where do we start? Maybe with artists who really shaped popular culture, the ones with enduring commercial value.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you almost have to start with Andy Warhol.
Right, the king of pop art.
Well, yes, but he was so much more. Draftsman, filmmaker, printmaker. He resisted labels, actually.
Oh, yeah.
He famously said, how can you say one style is better than another? You want to be able to be an abstract expressionist next week, or a pop artist, without feeling you've given up something.
Interesting. And of course, the soup cans in 62, that really launched him, didn't it?
Big time. That and the Marilyns, the Elizabeth Taylors.
Yeah.
Iconic stuff. Instantly recognizable.
So, okay, groundbreaking art, sure, but how does that translate into, you know, solid collateral for a lender? What's the financial angle?
Well, it's partly his story, I think. His personal history.
You mean from a poor immigrant family to basically New York royalty?
Exactly that journey. It adds to the mystique. Plus, his genius was reflecting and manipulating popular culture. He just got it.
And the market reflects that.
Massively. I mean, the auction results are just staggering. Silver car crash. Over $100 billion in 2013.
Wow.
Green car crash. Over $70 million in 2017. That kind of consistent high-level market performance, that's exactly what lenders look for.
So it's not just the price tag, it's the reliability, the fact that people consistently want it.
Absolutely. It's liquid. There's global demand. The provenance is usually well-documented. It's a known quantity, a very valuable one.
Okay, that makes sense. Warhol, capturing the everyday. What about David Hockney? Another huge name from that pop art era, but a different feel.
Definitely a different feel, but similar story in terms of market power and recognizability. Hockney's one of the most celebrated Western artists, period.
A bigger splash.
Yes.
You just know it's a Hockney.
Instantly. And his market performance, just look at A Portrait of an Artist, Pool with Two Figures, sold for $70 million in 2018.
$70 million, was that the record?
For a living artist at the time, yes.
It was huge. And part of his appeal, I think, is that transatlantic thing.
British roots, but that bright sort of Californian style. Exactly.
Yeah.
Working class Brit meets sunny America. It gives his work this really broad appeal. Keeps interest high, keeps prices high.
And for a lender, that broad appeal means less risk.
Less risk, yeah. Diversified demand. It's not just popular in one place. That helps stabilize its value as an asset.
Right. And staying with pop art, Tom Wesselman, he's often mentioned alongside Warhol and Lichtenstein.
He is, absolutely. Define that New York scene. But his work is really varied. Screen prints, collages, those huge billboard-style paintings.
The nudes, yeah.
Right. And later he did these amazing 3D metal pieces, too. He had this quote about getting excited by new ideas, feeling like it was almost dangerous.
Huh, I like that. Does that energy contribute to the value?
I think so. That contemporary feel, plus his historical importance.
Yeah.
Great American nude. 48 sold for, what, over $10 million?
Wow.
And, you know, you have to give a nod to artists like Rauschenberg, who kind of paved the way. But Wesselman definitely carved his own valuable space. Consistent style, key movement, reliable.
Okay, so pop art clearly holds its value. But now, maybe where things get a bit more edgy.
Yeah, this is where it gets really interesting. Artists whose value is tied up with controversy, big concepts, maybe very personal stuff.
And you have to start with Damien Hirst, right? The YBA poster child.
Oh, absolutely. Young British artists. Hirst is probably the most iconic, certainly the most controversial. And reportedly the UK's richest living artist.
The shark. Everyone knows the shark in formaldehyde.
The physical impossibility of death in the mind of someone living. Cost £50,000 to make, apparently.
And sold for?
Estimated around £8 million.
Just incredible.
And that's the thing with Hirst. His notoriety, the controversy, the sheer expense of making some pieces.
Hmm.
It all fuels the media attention and the prices.
Like the golden calf, the cow with gold horns.
Exactly. Sold for over 10 million pounds. And remember that massive Sotheby's auction he did? Beautiful inside my head forever.
Yeah, that was unprecedented, wasn't it? Bypassing the galleries.
Totally. Made 118 million. His ability to grab headlines, to provoke, that's intrinsically linked to the value.
So for a lender, the controversy isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Not necessarily. His work is instantly recognizable, highly visible, the high production value, the media buzz.
Yeah.
It actually ensures a certain kind of liquidity,
yeah.
Even for the really out there pieces. People talk about them. People want them.
It almost makes you wonder if controversy is needed for that top tier of contemporary value. Which brings us to Tracy Emin.
Another key YBA. Also controversial, also works in lots of different ways. Very, very personal work.
People might remember The Tent. Everyone I have ever slept with.
Right, which was famously misinterpreted. She meant literally slept, like shared a bed platonically or whatever, not always sexually.
Okay. But the most famous piece is probably...
Has to be My Bed.
Yeah. The unmade bed, the mess, basically.
Empty cigarette packs, used condoms, stained sheets. It reflected a period of severe depression for her. Caused an absolute storm.
And it sold for millions too, didn't it?
2.5 million pounds in 2014. It shows how that intense honesty, even the shocking stuff, connects with people. It proves that old saying, all publicity is good publicity, maybe.
So again, the notoriety helps.
It creates recognizability, discussion. Her major pieces are iconic now. For lenders, the provenance is clear, the status is undeniable. There's a solid market, even if it's fueled partly by that controversy. It maintains value.
Okay, switching gears a bit, but still talking about unique vision. Salvador Dali.
Ah, the master of surrealism.
Melting clocks, elephants on spindly legs, images you just don't forget.
Exactly. He was influenced by Picasso, but totally developed his own style. Tapping into dreams, the unconscious, rejecting rationality.
The persistence of memory instantly brings that image to mind.
Right. And he worked across so many mediums too, film, sculpture, photography. That adds depth to his market.
And the value is there.
Oh, absolutely. A portrait sold for over $21 million. Even the lobster telephone.
Lobster telephone.
Yeah. Fetched over 850,000 pounds. It shows how strong his brand, his vision is across different types of work.
So for a lender, Dali means?
Instantly recognizable style. Proven track record. Strong value retention. Whether it's a painting or a sculpture, it's identifiable. Authenticated easily. Solid.
Okay, so we've covered pop, provocation, surrealism. What about artists spanning different movements? Modernism, post-impressionism, where longevity and innovation really count.
Good question. Let's talk about Marc Chagall.
Russian-French modernist,
yeah.
Known for vibrant colors, maybe a bit folk art inspired.
Exactly. He synthesized cubism, symbolism, fauvism,
yeah.
Drew a lot from Jewish folk culture. Robert Hughes called him the quintessential Jewish artist of the 20th century.
Right.
And Picasso apparently said, when Matisse dies, Chagall will be the only painter left who understands what color really is.
Wow. Picasso said that.
So the story goes. And Chagall lived to be almost 100. He was incredibly prolific, did huge commissions, the Paris Opera ceiling, stuff for the UN.
So a long career, lots of work, major recognition, that equals a stable market.
A very broad and deep market, yes. Look at Lozamo. Sold for over 22 million pounds. For a lender, Chagall is almost the definition of stability. Long life, huge output, decades of critical and commercial success.
Makes his work very reliable as collateral, I guess.
Extremely reliable. But does being prolific always guarantee that? Not necessarily on its own. Look at Bernard Buffet.
Okay, Buffet. Parisian artist, known for that sort of bold, graphic style. Quite angular.
That's him. Very distinctive. He actually took a stand against abstract art.
Interesting. And how does he fit into this idea of commercial versus critical success?
Well, he's a fascinating case. Produced a huge amount of work, over 8,000 pieces.
8,000?
Yeah. And while he maybe never got that top-level critical acclaim during his life, he was commercially incredibly successful. People loved his work.
So the market was strong, even without the critics fully on board.
Very strong. Which explains why his art still commands high prices. Less clown musicians fetched £1 million. For lenders, Buffett shows that value can be driven by a dedicated collector base, independent of critical trends. That can actually mean less volatility sometimes.
That's a really interesting point. It's a complete contrast to someone like Van Gogh.
Oh, absolutely. The ultimate tragic artist story, isn't it?
Sold maybe one painting in his lifetime. Struggled so much.
Yeah. And yet now, He's one of the most prestigious, most sought-after artists in the world. It really makes you think about how legacies get reevaluated.
Totally. So how does that posthumous fame translate financially?
Well, his role in post-impressionism is just fundamental. Those colors, the brushwork, it changed everything. Now, the value is incredible. Even a charcoal drawing can fetch, say, $700,000.
Just a drawing.
Yep. And an oil painting like Fishing Net Mender's, over $8 million. For a lender, Van Gogh is like blue chip historical value, universally recognized, always in demand, extremely secure, even if finding one to lend against is rare.
Right, the rarity factor. Then someone totally different, Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Talk about explosive talent. Came up from street art, that graffiti background.
TMO, right?
Right. Developed this incredible, raw, African-inspired style. So much energy.
And his market appreciation has been, well, meteoric.
Phenomenal is the word. Just look at the stats. Between 2003 and 2017, some of his works increased nearly 97% in value.
Wow.
And that untitled painting, The Skull, sold for over $110 million in 2017.
$110 million. For an American artist, that was
a record at the time. Absolutely smashed it. For lenders, Basquiat represents high growth, high demand, high liquidity. Mm. Unique style, relatively limited supply because he died so young.
Makes his work very desirable collateral, assuming the paperwork is perfect.
Assuming provenance is rock solid, yes.
Yeah.
It's a prime high-growth collateral.
Okay, nearly there. Let's touch on a contemporary master, Sean Scully.
Irish-American painter. Huh. Known for those big abstract canvases. Stripes, blocks of color.
Right, sort of geometric but really emotive. Echoes of Rothko, maybe?
Yeah, there's a connection. But Scully has his own thing. There's Wall of Light paintings, the Landline series. He talks about wanting his art to be global.
How does that affect the value side?
He said, I want to make paintings that people everywhere can relate to. And that seems to have worked. His work is collected internationally. Landline Red Vein sold for over $1.5 million.
So that global appeal, it de-risks it for lenders.
Exactly. The market isn't dependent on one region's economy.
Mm.
There's always interest somewhere. It broadens the collector base, enhances liquidity, adds stability.
Makes sense. And finally, Raoul Dufy.
Ah, Dufy. Known for just joyful color, that decorative style. Very optimistic, often.
Yeah, his outdoor scenes, watercolors, they ended up on ceramics and textiles too, right? Very distinctive look.
They did. He had this lovely quote. I have found the essence of my painting in the journey and in the search. He was quite prolific.
Does being prolific affect the value here?
Well, for prints, sometimes a large output can dilute value a bit. But his paintings, especially the oils and key watercolors, hold their value really well. La Foire aux Oignons sold for over £6 million, for example.
So still very strong for the major works.
Definitely. His reputation, that recognizable style, lenders see his paintings as established assets with predictable valuation ranges, reliable collateral.
So quite a journey there, from pop icons through controversy, surrealism, modern masters.
It really shows the range, doesn't it?
It does. We've really dived into not just the what, but the why. Why these artists command such value, especially, you know, in this specific financial context.
Yeah. And it boils down to a mix of things, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Artistic innovation, sure. Cultural impact, definitely. Demand, both critical and commercial. Sometimes those compelling personal stories or controversies.
But underneath it all, for the lenders.
It's about the fundamentals. Proven market liquidity, can it be sold? Verifiable provenance, is it real and traceable? And a track record of holding value or even growing. That's what makes a masterpiece a solid financial asset.
So hopefully you listening have gained a bit more insight now into why these amazing artworks aren't just beautiful or important historically,
but are also serious players in the world of finance.
Yeah.
Assets used strategically.
Yeah. That's a fascinating intersection.
It really is. And maybe it leaves you with a thought.
Go on.
What does it actually mean for art, something so expressive, so human, to also be a commodity, a tangible, high-value asset?
Right. That dual nature.
And how does understanding that maybe change how we look at other valuable creative things, like, I don't know, rare first editions, or even things like NFTs and digital art in the future?
Definitely something to think about. Food for thought until our next deep dive.